get money for a good cause. Leo Luna, out.
We are rooted in community support.
Oh man, we ate that airtime. We ate that airtime like nachos.
That Schwarzenegger quote from the game. You can open it, but you can still original totally recall me.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor. You are weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, refusing to serve in apartheid Israel's military, instead protecting Palestinians from criminal assault by Jewish settler terrorists and their soldier buddies. We speak with a young Israeli who's doing both, and another voice from Israel USA's Dachau on the Med. Nurhan is a poet. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a quick appeal. If you appreciate what you're hearing, subscribe to the Green Planet Monitor at greenplanetmonitor.net. Now, the news with Kylie Wong.
As wildfires rage across Ontario, Mark Carney is doubling down on a new Alberta pipeline. In a video posted to X, Carney said the new pipeline will make Canada more independent by reducing oil exports going to the U.S. New Democratic Party leader Avi Lewis responded, saying the Prime Minister is incredibly brazen to boast about the lasting benefits of expanding fossil fuel production. This government is spending billions of dollars in public money to expand the very industry that's causing climate breakdown, Lewis said. Meanwhile, Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre posted a video criticizing Carney for having promoted carbon taxes and net zero emissions policies. Good news, everyone. The world is not coming to an end after all, Poilievre said. An algorithm is exposing black prisoners to harsher conditions, raising questions around AI bias in the Ontario prison system. The Security Assessment for Evaluating Risk, SAFER program, introduced in 2021, uses criminal justice data to determine carceral classifications, introducing anti-black bias into the prison system, prison rights advocates say. Government documents agree the algorithm discriminates. Mitigation measures introduced for Indigenous prisoners, they confirm, have not been extended to black prisoners. In a class action lawsuit, prison rights advocates allege the program reinforces racial discrimination through opaque decision-making, in violation of charter equality rights. Prison authorities just don't care, said Nana Yanful, a human rights lawyer. Canada and the U.S. may be at odds politically, but not militarily, Defense Minister David McGuinty says. Speaking at the Farnborough Airshow in the U.K., McGuinty said there is little daylight between Canada and the U.S. on defense security, and the close relationship will continue. Canada and the U.S. trust and rely on each other, McGuinty says. His comments come amid questions about Canada's planned purchase of American F-35 fighter jets. While Canada has committed to buying 30 of the killing machines largely responsible for the destruction of Gaza and the death of at least 100,000 Palestinians, the federal government is still reviewing whether to complete the full order of 88 jets, pegged at $74 billion. Aside from the F-35's murderous reputation and its role in the permanent war system, limited availability of U.S.-controlled software to operate the fighter jet troubles critics of the purchase. Two Vancouver activists are risking life in prison, following their challenge of laws they say are fueling Canada's overdose crisis. The pair distributed cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine that had been tested and were therefore free of the toxic substances currently plaguing drug users in large Canadian cities. The two activists now face possible life imprisonment. Punishing them amounts to violating the charter right of drug users to procure drugs that won't kill them, lawyers say. Sentencing has been delayed pending the constitutional challenge. The case highlights the failure of criminalization to curb overdose deaths and could set a precedent for expanding legal access to safer drugs across Canada. The Trump administration has stopped dropping bombs on Iran, for now. It does so following warnings from senior military officials that the Pentagon is running out of targets. Vice President J.D. Vance is at the forefront of efforts to relaunch negotiations. The Trump administration can't be negotiated with, Iranian officials say. Iran has temporarily stopped retaliatory attacks on ships navigating the Strait of Hormuz, as reported talks on reopening the strait continue, mediated by Oman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, under international warrant for war crimes and crimes against humanity, is expected to press Trump, a convicted felon, to resume full-scale war on Iran. And that's the news. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Kylie. countries, joining the army is something young men and women are willing to do if their country is actually under threat, or if they enjoy carrying a gun, following orders, and shooting people on command. Some do it for the money. Otherwise, joining the military is something young people typically don't want to do. Not so in Israel. The Israeli Defense Forces, or occupation forces, are the apartheid state's most revered institution. Obligatory conscription at the age of 18 is a rite of passage, a sacred duty to look forward to and embrace with Zionist pride. Those who don't, refuseniks they're called, are rare as hen's teeth, but there's a steady increasing trickle of them. Horrified by their country's genocide in Gaza, its permanent military occupation of the Palestinian West Bank, apartheid subjugation of the Palestinian people, and military seizure of Lebanese and Syrian territory, more young Israelis are doing so. Amit Orfali is one of these. Amit, 19 years old, is an Israeli refusenik. He's also directly involved in supporting Palestinian farmers and shepherds in the West Bank, increasingly subject to criminal assault and murder by Jewish settler terrorists and their soldier buddies. On a recent visit to Hamilton, Amit sat down with the GPM. Can you explain to me, Amit, how you came to these ideas of yours, how you decided at one point that you were going to be a conscientious objector? What this means in Israel, given the fact that everybody goes into the army?
Yes, it's not just the expectation, but it's considered an honor to serve the country, to be part of the military, of the IDF. From a very young age, as you said, people are being indoctrinated and brainwashed to think that this is what they're meant to do in life, defend their country and take part in the army. And for men especially, becoming a combatant or a pilot or an intelligence officer is something that is really considered a great, great honor, and I wanted to be one as well.
Now, that's pretty strong to say young people are brainwashed. How does this work?
It is, because from kindergarten and at home as well, the expectation of society is that after you finish high school, you immediately go to the army, no questions asked. And they teach you how to become a better soldier, that you need to sacrifice from yourself to the country, and you should get better grades because you want to be in better military units. You know, everything is about the army. And you should not have any disciplinary issues because you want to be in a good unit. That is the entire purpose of the education system, to prepare you for military service. And I told you a story last night about myself as a 6 years old, dressed up for Purim, which is a Jewish holiday where people dress up like in Halloween. And I was dressed up as a soldier, and I had a toy gun. And it's something so, so popular in Israel to be dressed up as soldiers, because this is what you dream to be. And so I think the word brainwashing, although very strong, is the right term to be used here.
Can you remember the moment when you decided you were going to refuse service?
That was a long process across 2023 and 2024, my two last high school years. And I started protesting against Netanyahu's government in particular, not against the Zionism, not against the occupation, but I was exposed. As I saw Netanyahu's government's crimes, I was exposed to a reality far greater than one government. The entire Zionist regime is maintaining an apartheid system in the West Bank and across Israel from the river to the sea. You know, there are, as you all know, almost 7 million Jews and a bit more than 7 million Arabs across this land. And they don't have equal rights. And this is only on the basis of blood. Then, in October 7th, 2023, it was a horrible day of a massacre against innocent people. But what followed afterwards was a genocide, really, that I watched it from my country that is committing it a few dozen kilometers from where I live. And I saw it all over the news. Not in Israel, of course, but foreign news, foreign media outlets and on social media. And I thought to myself that I cannot take part in an organization the army that he's committing something like that.
I mean, did you have friends who were also considering becoming conscientious objectors? Were you engaged in conversation at home with your family, with your siblings, with your classmates about whether or not to serve in the army, and even broaching the idea that you might not want to do it?
Well, as you must know, it's a very unpopular decision. And so out of the about 120 people in my class, only two did not enlist, myself and my partner. And we came to this decision together, and I think without him and without meeting other friends with the same moral values, with the same ideas of refusing, of objecting and resisting to the Israeli Zionist regime and system, without that I wouldn't be able to refuse. Because my family doesn't support it, most of my friends from high school don't support it, and many people cut their ties with me because I took this very unpopular decision. I've been regarded as a traitor by close family members because I don't enlist, because I don't take part in the war effort that most Israelis do actually see as an essential thing to their life, to their safety.
And how do you go about being a conscientious objector in Israel? What's the process by which you say, I'm not going to serve? And what are the immediate consequences of saying, I'm not going to serve?
Right. Apart from social consequences, of course, there are a few avenues not to serve in the military for secular children, for secular Jewish people. The first one is getting a medical exemption, either by a doctor or a psychiatrist. The other avenue is to refuse to enlist and then go to military prison as a part of a political campaign. Some of my friends have done that. They declared their political objection to Israel and tried to make a media campaign about them going to prison. Some of them even went to prison for more than 180 days. And the third avenue, which I took, is facing a conscientious committee, which is made up of a few high-ranking military officers and a philosophy professor from the academia. And this committee it tests whether you're a pacifist, whether you object to the idea of an army, and especially of you serving in an army, whether that would break you morally and mentally, or whether you have actual political objections to this specific army, to the IDF, to the occupation. And this they do not exempt. This is not considered conscientious objection in Israel. It even a case like that was ruled in the Israeli Supreme Court in the early 2000s, a conscientious objector that resisted the occupation specifically and not the idea of an army, he was sentenced to military prison time. And I managed to convince the committee that I'm a pacifist.
And they must look at you and treat you as if you're kind of unworthy, to put it mildly. There's a stigma to refusing to serve with the Israeli occupation forces, isn't there?
Yes, and I'll tell you a short story from my second time facing the committee, because you get two attempts. I failed the first one to convince them, and then in the second one, the appeal, I succeeded. And in the second one, they asked me, what am I going to do? And I said, well, I don't know in particular, but I thought... I think that I'll help people. I'll dedicate my life to helping other people. And they, those generals, they laughed and they said, oh, sounds like a military career to me.
And these are people in uniform.
Yeah, people in uniform think that what they do in the military in 30 or 40 years of service is helping other people. That's actually what they think. It's that deep. They don't see their crimes.
So you did not serve jail time?
No.
What are the consequences of not serving in the IDF, right? I mean, everybody serves in the IDF, and there are all sorts of civil, social, national rights that accrue to young Israeli men and women who
right.
serve in the army. And this is brings us to this idea that, you know, Israeli Palestinian citizens of Israel, they have citizenship rights, but they don't have national rights.
Right.
And many of those national rights arise from the fact that they might have served in the IDF, but Palestinians, almost with the exception of Druze, they don't serve, Palestinian Israelis don't serve in the IDF. And so they don't get any of the rights and the privileges that are associated with having served in the IDF. Can you talk about this? Like, what are you kind of cut off from not having served in the IDF?
There are some financial benefits for serving in the IDF, like a grant that you get after you finish, you complete your service, and tax benefits for several years after you finish the military service, as well as, I think, some sort of enhanced scholarship to university, to a first degree. But I think the most significant sanction is not a formal one. Sanction, of course, quote-unquote, is the social one, not the formal one, that you're being excluded from Israeli society, that you'll have you have a lower chance to be accepted to jobs, to the job market, because people are really interested in what you did during your military service. It's being looked as if it's a part of your education, as if it's a part of your life path.
It's part of your CV. It's in your resume.
Yeah. And if you don't do that, that's a major red flag for many Israelis, both in the formally in job market as well as informally in society. I'll never be part of mainstream Israeli society, not that I want to, but because of my decision not to take part in this.
What do Israelis, young Israelis, know about Israel's occupation?
That depends, because there are many different groups in Israel.
Because many of them, I mean, when you join the IDF, I don't know what percentage of recruits in the IDF end up in the Palestinian West Bank, in East Jerusalem, or in Gaza, for that matter, in South Lebanon, or in Syria.
I can tell you that there are huge parts of Israeli society that are very right-wing, and they think that Israel should just kick out all the Arabs, do a formal ethnic cleansing. Especially amongst young people, that's a very popular idea, because, especially after October 7th, because of this huge revenge feeling that they have, that we should revenge and avenge the Palestinians for what they did to us on October 7th, like we didn't do enough. But I think where I grew up, in Givatayim near Tel Aviv, it's a more liberal place. And so most 18 years old don't think that we should kill or kick out all Palestinians. And that they just think that everything that we do, everything that Israel does, is necessary in order to protect the safety of its citizens. Some do recognize that Israel does occupy the Palestinian West Bank illegally. Some think it's actually a legal occupation, because they claim there was never a Palestinian state and we occupied it from Jordan, and so it's actually a legal occupation. But even the people that see that this is immoral towards the Palestinians, they think it is absolutely necessary and couldn't have been any other way, in order to protect the safety of themselves, of their families in Israel. In my view, that is not only the wrong decision, the wrong opinion morally. Like you completely disregard the well-being of the Palestinians, but it's also the wrong decision strategically, because I think it would be safer for Israelis to end the occupation. I think it would be better for Israel, I don't know, for the state, I don't care. I care about the human rights of the Israeli citizens, because I care about universal human rights. But I think it would be better for Israelis not to occupy another people, and I think it should be straightforward.
And do you speak to other young people about your conscientious objector status? Do you speak to your friends who served in the IDF, who are serving there now?
Well, most of my friends who from high school who ended up being in the IDF cut all their ties with me because of my decision. And before that, I did speak with them a lot about my decision about why I think it's true that you can't take part in the army, and why I think I'm right and they should do it as well. But I think that even the people that started seeing what I see couldn't do it socially, because it's really a social suicide. And this plays a huge factor in many Israelis' decision to enlist, is that everyone enlists, everyone goes to the army, and you just don't want to miss out. It's like not going to college. It's like you make yourself an outcast of society.
I mean, I wonder what experiences and reflections young Israelis come back from the West Bank to their homes in Tel Aviv, what they come back with, and they come back on for weekends, and they go back to the West Bank or wherever they're serving. Let's assume they're serving in the West Bank. What that leaves with them with emotionally, what their reactions are to serving day in and day out in the Palestinian territories and villages, systematically humiliating Palestinians, seeing settlers attack them, bulldozing their homes, preventing them from moving in and out of their villages, you know, serving at checkpoints.
Yeah, I think that would leave not only psychological impact on the people, on the soldiers doing that, but also sociological consequences for the entire society of Israel. And I think this is a reason why we see a rise in violence against women since October 7th in Israel, in Israeli society, because more people are armed, more men especially are reservists, are fighting and are being used to a life of violence. They're getting used to humiliating Palestinians, including Palestinian women, and then they come back home, and that's their behavior now. It impacts them. It impacts the core of Israeli society. And those 18 years old that go to the West Bank and do all of those crimes, or to Gaza, I don't blame them individually. I blame the system for sending them armed to do all of those horrible crimes. And they are also sort of victims, because they would face those consequences, of course, for their entire life. Of course, those of them who think what they did is wrong, most of them don't. But we can see in Haaretz articles and in Shuvrim Shtika, Breaking the Silence, testimonies of soldiers telling how horrified they are by what they did and what their colleagues did in Gaza and in the West Bank.
And Breaking the Silence, for those who don't know, is an Israeli Jewish organization consisting of former soldiers who served in the IDF who now regret what they did and
yes.
are breaking the silence.
Yeah. And there was a specific article in Haaretz very recently that brought a testimony of a soldier, an officer who served in Gaza. I think he was a regiment commander or something like that. And he said, my soldiers shot people who crossed the yellow line, who even though some of them were not armed. And then when the IDF tried to investigate the case, I lied for them. I said that they were a threat. Those Palestinians were a threat to my soldiers. And
that's what that soldier
yeah.
said.
Even though I know that's not true. And so in Israel, they would be just classified as terrorists who were killed trying to attack Israeli soldiers in Gaza. And the soldiers acted as expected.
Tell me about your accompaniment work.
Yes, that is, I think, the most important piece of activism anyone can do, especially in Israel. You mean protective presence.
Protective presence. And
yes.
How did you get involved in protective presence?
Yes. This is an activism in the West Bank that Jewish, Israelis, and international activists come to Palestinian communities that face harassment, intimidation, and attacks on a daily basis from settlers that are being protected by the army. And we come to those Palestinian communities. We stand with them against the settler attacks. We document. We try to contact the authorities that at least seem trying to seem to be neutral and protect the Palestinians, which they mostly don't. But we give them support and solidarity. That is so important to do that. And I started doing it in January of this year after a friend really urged me to come because there was a shortage of activists, like there is constantly in our area of East Ramallah. And I couldn't stop. It consumed my life. I went to the West Bank a few times a week for the entire months after January that I've been in Israel. And I was pepper sprayed by settlers, and I saw fellow activists being attacked. And I witnessed with my own eyes how Palestinian families fled from their homes after a combined settler and army forced them out of their homes.
And this is the astonishing thing, that settlers work together with, in partnership with, soldiers.
Yes.
You've got soldiers who are settlers, settlers who are soldiers, and they're in uniform, they're out of uniform. They're all on the same team.
Absolutely. And this story that I just said about the eviction, the displacement of the Shakara community east of Douma is a great example of how those two forces work together.
And where's Douma?
Douma is in the Nablus district of the West Bank.
And Nablus is in the northern, kind of north central West Bank.
Yes, yes. And let me tell you this story, because for months, settlers, after establishing a new outpost, they attacked this Bedouin community. They came every day with their flocks, they pepper sprayed Palestinians, they attacked activists, they threatened and intimidated, and they always told us to tell the Palestinians, because they don't speak Arabic, that you'll be gone. One day we'll come and you'll be gone. And for months, this community managed to hold on, because activists spend their nights, day and nights, in sleeping there and being with them and helping them also financially, because they couldn't work. Their entire existence was to keep their home. This is what they did. And so we helped them and supported them with every power that we had. But we did everything we could.
Every day, day and night.
Yes, 24/7, with international activists and Israeli activists. But then came March 2nd, 2026, and the Israeli army, some officer perhaps, thought, okay, this is enough. The day of this community has come in the story of this ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. And they signed a closed military zone order, which means that anyone who doesn't live there must be banned from the area. And then they came, the soldiers came, and they...
Except settlers.
The law of the order says anyone who doesn't live there.
Yeah.
And then the soldiers came and they banned our activists from the area. Yeah, they expelled them. But they didn't enforce the same order, which is very clear, on the settlers. The settlers were allowed to stay in the area. They were allowed to attack the Palestinians because we weren't there and the army wouldn't stop them. And it was on March 3rd, a single day after the order was given, that the first home was destroyed. And it was on March 5th, just 3 days after the closed military zone order was declared, that the entire community of 14 families, including many children and women, had to leave their home.
Driven out by settlers.
Yeah.
Backed by soldiers.
Absolutely. It would not have happened without the direct involvement of the State of Israel. You cannot say this is just settler violence that drove the Palestinians out. It is Israel, with a direct policy of the army, conducted by the army, of enforcing one law on the Palestinians and the activists, and a different one for the settlers, that made the Palestinians flee their homes. This is ethnic cleansing that, you know...
It's apartheid.
Yes, but it's all directed and meant by the Israeli government. It's not accidental.
Yeah, it's a state-sponsored